I have a little present, a little demo at the end, but unfortunately it's on this computer, which is not compatible with this Beamer. And so if we have time for a presentation or for the demo, maybe we have to do this here, but we're not that many, so it should be okay. So what is this presentation about? We're going to talk about transactions at the system level, and it's a way of writing more reliable and safer software and make that easy as well. I will start with some examples, very simple things that you find in typical applications, and from there we do a little bit of theory, and then we go to practice, and in the end hopefully the pieces will fit together and everything will make sense. So let's start with this example, something you, I think, typically find in an application. There are two file descriptors. It's Unix C code. There are two file descriptors. There's a main loop. It waits for an input. It fills an input buffer, does some computation for an output buffer, and then writes the output to the two file descriptors. The usual example I give for this is of a weather monitoring station, which maybe wakes up once per minute. It reads sensor data from the sensors. It computes an output buffer, maybe adding new values from the sensor data. I don't know if you have temperature and absolute humidity. I think you can compute relative humidity and things like that, or maybe fix up units. And then our weather monitoring station takes the output buffer and writes it to a file and to a backup file. And maybe once per day, it switches on the Wi-Fi and transfers all the day's data to a central server for further weather processing. Usually, this works quite well, but one day, the following happens. We wake up, we read the sensor data, we compute the output buffer, then we write to the first file, and we try to write to the second file, and now our disk is full. And that brings us into something like a bad situation here. Careful. That brings us something like a bad situation here, because we are now in something like an inconsistent state. I think it's fair to assume that the file FD0 and the backup file FD1 always contain the same data. But we only wrote FD0, and writing FD1 didn't work. The disk is full. So if we want to go into consistent state, we either have to go forward in the program, which is not possible, the disk is full, but we can't go back either in the previous state because we already wrote that first file. So basically, we messed up consistency of the program state, and we did so by messing up error handling. Here's the second example. This time we have only one file descriptor, but two threads. The first thread, it computes an output buffer and writes to the file descriptor. The second thread, it reads from the file descriptor and processes the input buffer. So in the weather monitoring station, the first thread could be part of the measuring code, which reads the sensor data and writes it to the file. And maybe once per day, the Wi-Fi gets switched on automatically. Thread two runs, reads all the data from the file, and process input buffer could then transfer it to the server. And you see immediately what is wrong here. These two threads run concurrently. At least they can run concurrently. And there is zero concurrency control, and there's no synchronization. So whenever thread one writes something to the file, thread two could come in, read, and the result is undefined. So another case where we messed up program state, this time by messing up concurrency handling. Now let's take I hope there's no one in the live stream with headphones. Okay. Let's take a bit more abstract look at what we wanted in our examples. First point, we wanted some kind of atomicity here. So when we do our write in the second example, we don't want the reader thread to come in and read while we do that. next point, you wanted some kind of consistency. Like in the first example, consistency means that if we have our file and our backup file, we don't want them to disagree what the current sensor measurements are. Now with the third point, you can already guess where this slide is going. Isolation is our third point. So whatever these threads in example two do when they run concurrently, we don't want them ever to interfere. And one of them, or the effects of one of them, is always isolated from the other one. And of course, fourth point, durability. When we did our progression from a consistent state into a new consistent state, we don't want the system to go back to the previous state. So, well, that's the ASIC properties, of course. What we wanted were transactional semantics for our examples. When you think of transactions, there are often databases what you think of, but there's hardly anything for arbitrary software. Databases work fairly well for what they are made for, but it's kind of always a world of their own. So keep transactions in mind, please. And let's take a closer look at one of the system calls we had in the example. So pwrite is the system call which writes to a file given as file descriptor. There is a buffer which is written, there is a buffer length given in count, and the offset is just the place where we write to the file. And imagine you have pwrite in your application that is simply one line usually, then you need error handling or at least error detection, like three or four additional lines. And when pwrite signals that it didn't work, basically report an error to the calling function and be out. Then in the examples we had concurrency, second example, and that means we require logging to handle that. So first of all, we have to take a log. If that doesn't work, go out. If it succeeds, do the pwrite. If that doesn't work, release the log and then go out. Otherwise, we unlock the log and we report success. Now imagine we have two pwrite calls. First idea could be, well, just copy what we already have. So log pwrite unlock, log pwrite unlock. But there is this isolation and atomicity constraint which we just had. So we cannot just duplicate the code as it is. What we can do, however, is to reorder these things a bit. So we first do all the locking. Then we do the pwrites, and then we do the unlocking. So require the first lock for the first pwrite. If that doesn't work, just go out. If that works, we acquire the second pwrites lock. If that doesn't work, release the first lock, then go out. If it works, we do the first pwrite. If that doesn't work, release the locks, go out. If that works, we do the second pwrite. And now we are back into the situation which we had in the first example, because now if that second pwrite fails, we have to go out, but we already did that first pwrite. So what we can do is to do a kind of speculative write. And that means we don't actually do the pwrite when we get the call. Instead, we just collect the buffers and collect the logs and delay the actual pwrite to when we're done. So now, get the first log. If that doesn't work, go out. Get the second log. If that doesn't work, release the first log, go out. If that works, don't really do the pwrite, just collect the buffers. We already have our logs. Then the second pwrite, don't really do the pwrite, just collect the buffer. And now we could do that with more pwrites and more statements. And at some point, we're done with that, and we have collected all the buffers we're going to write. Now, what we can now do is verify that all these buffers and writes we collected are actually going to make it to the disk. So we can validate if there is enough disk space, if there is enough memory. We can even pre-allocate resources we need for our apply operation. And when we're sure that all these things actually work, and we maybe even pre-allocated resources, We apply the writes one by one, and then we're done and release our logs, and then we succeeded. And the point here is that while we are collecting buffers and doing these pwrite stub code, we can always abort and go back, and we have not really changed anything up to the point where we do the first apply. And at that point, we can be fairly sure that things will work. Okay, so basically there are like three phases. Execute, the first one for our pwrite. This is where we get the buffer, where we collect the buffer, maybe get the log. And then we are done with that. If we really want to apply, there is an apply operation for pwrite, which means maybe do some validation and then do the actual write. And until we reach that apply, we can always call undo, and undo basically undoes what we did in execute. And the point here is that executes can be reordered with the applies. So we first do all the executes and collect what we have and things, and then we do another validation step, and at the end we do the apply, and then we're done. And basically, we can implement that, and that brings us back to our transactional code. At this point, the slides are getting a bit more practical. So at this point, we're getting a bit more practical. We're coming to PicoTM. It's a transaction manager, C applications, or firmware, or anything that is can be considered systems programming. But systems programming, C, is basically what I do. The concepts of transactional execution can be applied to any problem or any programming language. So what is PicoTM? It's basically a set of C libraries. And is it better that way? Okay. So it's basically a set of C libraries which provide transactional versions of common commands. In your C application, you will find these three statements. PicoTM begin, commit, and end. Begin begins a transaction. Then comes the execution phase, where all these execute statements are. So this is where we collect the buffers. And at the end, when we collected all the buffers for pwrite, or maybe prepared other operations, we do the commit. And during the commit, there is another validation step to see if everything works, if everything is going to actually be performed by the system. And then we call, as part of the commit, the apply functions, where we do the actual operations like writing pwrite buffers. If that succeeds, we go straight to end, and then we're done with our transaction. If it does not succeed, we can always go back up to the point where we do the commit and started applying operations. So let's say somewhere between begin and commit, something goes wrong. We see, okay, we have this read now. We have this right now, and there's no way this is ever going to work, or there's an internal problem, I don't know, we're out of memory, something like that. We just roll back our transaction, and what happens next is we don't try immediately again. We go to a piece of code located between commit and end, and it is what I call recovery phase. And that recovery is provided by the application programmer and gives has code for repairing errors or trying to handle errors that happen during execution. So it's all a bit theoretical. Maybe let's come back to the initial example. So again, we have this main loop of our weather monitoring station. We're waiting for input, so we're waking up once per minute. And then we start our transaction. Fill input buffer tx with the function that reads from the sensors. And maybe there is a problem with the sensors. It's not well calibrated. And if fill input buffer tx detects that the sensors don't give meaningful data, it doesn't return an error to our transaction. It does not just do nothing. Instead, it instructs the PicoTM framework to roll back the transaction and start recovery. And that means just go back to beginning, go back to the recovery block at the end. And there you have this handle arrow and retry function, which is provided by a programmer of the application. And for those miscalibrated sensors, it could try to calibrate the sensors. And if it thinks it did that, there's PicoTM restart. And restart sends it back to the beginning. Now we try again. Next iteration through our transaction, we fill the input buffer. This time we calibrated the sensors, and it works. And we get meaningful sensor data into our input buffer. Now we try to compute the output buffer. Maybe there is a pair of malloc and free operations within compute output buffer tx. And maybe there is not enough memory available on the system, so malloc fails. And again, compute output buffer tx detects that, but it does not return an error to the transaction. It does not just do nothing. It instructs the PicoTM framework that an error occurred and it should start recovery. So PicoTM rolls back the transaction to beginning, goes to the recovery block into handle arrow and retry. And this time, I don't know, freeing up memory could mean running a garbage collector, releasing some buffers, or caches somewhere. So we free up memory in our recovery block. If we did that, we call restart again, go back to beginning, restart our transaction. We read the sensor data, we compute the output buffer, everything works this time. We do the first write, but not really the write itself. We just do this collect buffer step. We collect the buffer for the second write. Now we're at commit, and maybe we detect, okay, we have all this data in the buffers. It's not going to ever be written successfully to our disk. Again, commit does not do nothing, not return an error or anything. Instruct the framework to go to recovery, so we roll back our transaction. This time, we actually have something to undo. Undoing here means throw away these buffers from the writes. Release the allocated memory that we got from malloc. And then we're back in our original state at begin. We go to the recovery phase, handle error and retry. This time could try to release temporary files, compress files, something like that. So we free up this space. We again go to the restart. Restart sends us up to the beginning of the transaction. We read the sensor data. We compute the output buffer, collect the write buffers. Then we're at commit. We do another validation step. This time, everything looks fine. And we finally apply the operations, and then we're done. And we go to end. So any transaction that went through a successful recovery is not different from the same transaction which committed at the first try. And you might ask now, OK, so what happens if we're in a commit and we already did the first apply? And despite our best efforts to not break or not mess up, suddenly something goes really wrong and we cannot perform the second apply. That's indeed a problem, and that's kind of a shortcoming or a feature of the Unix API. It depends on how you look at it. In that case, the minimum thing we can always do is go straight to recovery. And there's this other branch, PicoTM arrow is non-recoverable. And that signals that we just saw an error where there's no way for recovering from. And basically, the system is in an inconsistent state. And the least thing we can always do is send an email to the administrator and then shut down the system gracefully. There are ways for handling that with two-phase commits and with structured data. but the plain Unix API doesn't support that well. Okay, so just a few words about how this is implemented. So the PicoTM framework keeps a log for each transaction that is running. Here is the full transaction log for the first example. So there is this malloc, then there is a free, there are the two write operations. And depending on whether we commit or roll back the transaction, either we have to apply the free, the write, the two writes, or we have to undo the malloc. And PicoTM works over these events depending on what we do. Here's the second example, this time as transactions. And second example here, it computes an output buffer, which is written in the first thread. And in the second thread, the transaction just reads. And first of all, you will notice that the error handling code is exactly the same. And that's intentional, because the error recovery there is usually independent from where the errors happen. So when you see an out-of-memory error, there are only so many things you can try, like running a garbage collector. But it doesn't really matter where the error happens. I already left out that section in the second thread. So coming back to what we actually want to do here. So we have the first thread, which writes, and we have the second thread, which reads in a transaction. This time it works, because we have this locking in our execute operations. So when we arrive in the first thread at the pwrite, it acquires the lock for the file descriptor and for the file state and where we're going to write. And if we have that second transaction coming to the same point, but those locks are taken, then the framework, the transaction framework, observes the conflict and resolves that conflict. So either we write or we read. Most or basically all of the actual functionality is implemented as modules on top of kind of a core framework. So there's the structure module ops, and it has a number of function callbacks for locking, unlocking, applying, and undoing events or cleaning up. And if you have a module like, say, this file IO which we just had, or memory allocation, your module fills in these pointers and hands it over to the framework, which this register module function. And from there, you can use the transaction framework and the transaction framework will call your module when it wants it to do something. If you have an operation that has to put an event into event log, there is append event. With the module number, the operation, and this cookie thing is entirely module dependent. And if you see an error or a conflict between transactions, there's recover from error. The error structure gives information what actually went wrong, like, I don't know, error codes or which log observed the conflict. And basically, that's the basic module API. And as I said before, this is C for systems programming, but the general idea is portable to any problem or any programming language. Except basic, maybe. OK, so there are quite a few modules. First is transactional memory. Transactional memory is similar to what we have seen in the in these file IO examples, just that it operates on memory. So there is tx underscore x, which is a global shared variable. There's this transaction where we load the value of this tx underscore x into the transaction context, do a bit of math on it, and then store the result back into the global variable. If there is any concurrent transaction operating on that variable, the transactional memory module will detect the conflict and resolve it. Besides load and store, there is an operation called privatize. And load and store always copy. Privatization gives you the actual memory buffer where this shared variable is located, the memory region. And with that, you can build things like string or memcopy. So here, very similar, but a bit different. There's a buffer. There's a transactional memset. There's an in the memset TX function. There's an internal privatized operation. So our transaction acquires TX buff at this point. Then we do a regular memset into that buffer. And because of that privatization step, if there is any concurrent transaction operating on that buffer, the system will detect that and roll back. There's malloc and free, and clog and realloc and that kind of stuff. So if you want to do memory allocation, this is supported. If you have to roll back, or if the transaction has to roll back between the malloc and free operation, then the malloc operation automatically be undone. So that memory is not leaked. then supported is safe typecasting and arithmetic. So when you do typecasting and arithmetic, there's always this problem of overflows or underflows. If you have divisions, you don't want to divide by zero. So given in that example is a combination of both modules. First, we load the value in TX underscore X. It's casted then to short. If that overflows or underflows, we go to recovery automatically. Otherwise, we have now our int variable as short value. We do some arithmetic on it, multiply, add, and divide. If any of that overflows, underflows, or if we had a division by zero here, these functions would trigger transactional recovery. So we would go back to the beginning and then to the recovery block and so on. If all this works, we have another cast operation where we cast it back to an integer value. And then we do a store into the global memory region. This example also illustrates that modules can be mixed and matched freely. They are all built on the same foundations of error handling and concurrency control. And that's why they all work together. Another module provides data structures. Currently, there are lists and queues, multisets, and stacks. And these can be used, or have to be actually used, from within transactions. And if there is concurrency on these data structures, the framework will detect that and will handle it accordingly. So given here is this TX list state, which is kind of a non-transactional global state for this list. And in our transaction, we first do a malloc of some memory to get a new entry. And we initialize the entry in the second line of the transaction. And then this third instruction kind of acquires a transactional representation of this known transactional list state. And that transactional representation is our actual list. And that's the data structure which has the transaction local state. And it's also the data structure which or with which we can interact with. And that's what we do in the final line. The pushback TX function adds entry to the end of this list. So it will be the final element in the list when the commit is successful. If there is a problem somewhere between pushback TX and commit, then the entry will be removed automatically during the rollback, and also the malloc operation will be undone automatically during the rollback. And of course, the entry will then not be in the list state. Then FileIO, I had this in the example. It's, as I mentioned, not without limitations. because Unix does not support this really well. But let's say you're an embedded system, and the embedded system, it has, I don't know, not really Unix, but some kind of minimal operating system, and you have direct access to the flash memory, for example. You could have something like a transactional file system on a flash memory, and don't use Unix API, use something that is tailored towards this kind of code. So here, in the example is very similar to the examples we already had. There is a file descriptor and a buffer, and basically we read from the file descriptor into the buffer. And if we commit, the read is successful. If not, then we don't change file descriptor or file state. Other supported is Arno handling. So if you have a transaction, you modify Arno somewhere. In that transaction, you have to roll back. Next iteration through the transaction, you will see the original Arno value. Also supported is the C standard math library, more or less all the functions that are specified by POSIX. And like in the case of arithmetics, if you do something that doesn't work, if you have an overflow or you do something like, I don't know, take a square root of a negative number, these functions will detect the problem, roll back the transaction, go to recovery, and so on. There's some file system support as well, but it's not really compatible with the transaction concepts unless your file systems support that natively, but Unix does not really support that. But as I mentioned, on embedded systems where you can make up your own file systems API, could do that, no problem. So some ideas for the future. Support for embedded and really tiny systems. Right now I work on Unix or things that look like Unix. Tiny systems is for me something that has memory measured in kilobytes, that does not run Linux, but maybe some really primitive operating system or no operating system. I think this is mostly, at this point is mostly about stripping down the implementation that is currently there, removing things or making them optional. And I'd like to be able to handle Unix signals. There are things like segmentation faults, this is the first one. Sigbus is a bus error. It's something like a segmentation fault, but with physical addresses. And sigil is when you try to execute an illegal instruction which is not supported by the CPU. In all these cases, your hardware will basically raise the exception, and Unix will immediately forward the exception, and there is one chance to handle them. And it would be nice if the transaction would not just abort like it does in regular code, but go to recovery. And what I also would like to support, but that's kind of more of a long-term project, is two-phase commits and real transaction tailored data formats or network protocols. So with two-phase commits, what you usually do is that you maybe have a set of write operations into a file, you do all them, and then you flip one single flag somewhere, and then you enable them all with that single flag. And that basically the writing is the first phase of the commit, and the flag flipping is the second phase of the commit. What I have in mind is to kind of support that as well and have it built in a way that is that can be used across module boundaries. So basically what I want to do is to have something like an embedded system where you do a read, then you have a network protocol which transfers the data to a server where you write. And those are two local transactions which then commit as one large distributed transaction. But that's still a bit work to do. It's not that easy as it sounds. Okay. That was kind of a really quick and brief overview of transactional programming and illustrating the idea behind it. I hope I could convince you, or at least make a good point, why transactional code is safer than the original non-transactional code which we had here. Basically, because the framework allows us to go between consistent states only. All inconsistent intermediate states are somehow, well, they never become global shared state in the system. We only move from consistent state to consistent state. And all the complicated things like error handling and concurrency control is basically done once within the modules, or maybe error recovery is done once by the application, and that is shareable across all the programs which use the modules, or across all the applications which use the same recovery code. Yeah, so the framework itself is open source. It's available at pkdm.org. Occasionally, I write in my blog about that topic, but I'm kind of a bit of a lazy writer, so I try to do this once per week, but nah. Okay, and if you have questions, or you can also send me an email. So if you don't remember anything, remember pkdm.org. And that's our mascot, that's Kate. And unfortunately, I do have a demo, but the demo is, as I mentioned, on this computer, and I have to use that computer because this one isn't compatible with the Beamer. If there's interest, I would set this up afterwards. Otherwise, we could have Q&A if there are any questions. Yeah. Oh, wait a second. There's a live stream.
Oh, okay. Do you have any dependencies on the architecture side? So do you have to have any special instructions or something like that? Or is it just plain C? Maybe I missed it in the beginning.
You mean CPU instructions?
Yeah, something like that.
It's plain C.
Okay.
It's C11.
Okay.
Those begin, commit, and end statements, they are basically macros around some simple C code. There's no magic, basically. And there is no compiler extension. There is no CPU support required.
OK.
Is it possible to nest this transactions?
There are two kinds of nesting transactions. Deep nesting and flat nesting, I think it's called. The flat version should not be too hard. So basically for the rest of the audience, so when you have a transaction and you do another transaction within, the easy implementation is to just increment a counter in the internal begin statement and decrement it during the commit. And when you have reached zero again in your counter, you do the actual commit, so you can nest this easily. I think the problem is, if you have a nested error handling block, that's kind of an implementation complexity. You know, if you have this, you have an outer transaction, an inner transaction, and the inner transaction fails, you probably want to go to the inner recovery. And if that doesn't do what you want, you want to go to the outer recovery. It is possible to implement, but it's not supported.
Thanks for the talk. Do you have any numbers on the performance or performance impact?
Depends a lot on the operation. So the very short answer is no. The long answer is I have a performance test tool which runs for the transactional memory module. And it has some kind of synthetical benchmark stuff. Basically, I'm doing 100 loads and stores in a transaction on a buffer of several kilobyte. And I think I'm seeing like several 10,000 committed transactions for random access pattern, and for sequential access, something like, I don't know, 100,000 and a few more. But I have no idea if that is good or bad. So the real answer is I have data, but it's probably not useful. The data I have is for me more or less to see, am I getting better or worse? I think if you really want to measure the overhead, you have to fine-tune the application, and you have to fine-tune such a framework for the specific problem that you're trying to handle. So there are no real data. There's no real data which is useful.
Thanks.
There's another question.
What will I have to do to register own functions and to make them participate in this framework?
You came later. There was this slide. Have you seen this slide, or otherwise I will go through it again. Sorry.
Yes.
Okay. So a simple example would be malloc and free. If you have a malloc operation, what you have to do is to, when you do the malloc successfully, you want to put an event into the lock, which is done by append event. And first time you do the malloc operation in your transaction, you have to register your module. And registering the module for malloc, the only thing that is required by malloc is an undo if you roll back. Otherwise, you would leak that malloc buffer. So you have to write an undo event function. And when the transaction framework rolls back, it will automatically call that function if your event is in the lock. There are no more questions, then thank you for attending. Okay. If anyone is interested, I have a demo on this computer.